Would you take your Bible and turn to Mark chapter 16? You will find that on the screen here in a minute. Maybe you've got your Bible with you, or you have a handheld device, a phone or an iPad. All we ask is you turn down the sound so we don't hear whether you're winning or losing your game. Matthew 16. And we'll begin in verse number 1. I'm glad you're here this morning. I'm glad to see Leroy. Leroy's right back here, and some of you may be hearing for the first time that Leroy said goodbye to his wife of 47 years yesterday afternoon, and he's here on Easter Sunday morning, and we're glad he is. Mark chapter 16, beginning in verse number 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they could go and anoint him. Very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb at sunrise. They were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone from the entrance to the tomb for us?" Looking up, they noticed that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. When they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side. And they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he told them. "You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they put him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you to Galilee. You will see him there, just as he told you." They went out and ran from the tomb, because trembling and astonishment overwhelmed them. And they said nothing to anyone, since they were afraid. You know, sometimes you plan an Easter sermon, and then an event happens, and you think, well, you know, that probably ought to be a point of reference. And so, when we finish here in about 45 minutes to an hour, just making sure you're listening, making sure you're listening. When we're through in a moment, what I hope more than anything else is that you understand that the good news is a declaration. It's an announcement. And the announcement is pretty simple. Jesus is our new beginning. It's just as simple as that. Jesus is our new beginning. If we miss anything else, if I fail in what I'm given to do this morning, hopefully when you go out those double doors into that cool early afternoon, you'll remember at least this. Jesus is our new beginning. Leroy arrived with not a whole lot of time to spare yesterday. Eunice had not been herself for some time. They, as I mentioned already, they spent 47 years together. And Leroy is no medical doctor. His favorite line is, "It's not the years, it's the miles." Isn't that right, Leroy? And so, as much as he could gather from what the doctors and the nurses were conveying, he had the sense that it wouldn't be long. He didn't have to know the medical lingo. He didn't have to kind of have an inside scoop, if you will. He simply knew what they were indicating was it wasn't going to be long. So we were standing there talking yesterday. Eunice had never really gotten over her pneumonia. She had now had a collapsed lung to make things and make matters worse. And while we were talking, she breathed her last. And over the course of my conversation with Leroy, I learned something I didn't know about my friend of more than 20 years. A nurse came in. It was her job. Maybe we would call her kind of a caseworker, a social worker. She came in, and she made sure Leroy knew that she was there for him. Eunice had gone. And now the concern was, does he need anything? And she bent over and talked to him, and he said this, and I wrote it down. "We were married 47 years, It was a second marriage. My first wife died of cancer. I called it my second honeymoon. Isn't that great? Leroy had a new beginning of sorts. After the experience of death and loss, he spent just more than half of his 90 years, just more than half of his 90 years with his new wife, Eunice. I mean, who of us wouldn't like a new beginning? Maybe you are in Leroy's position. Maybe you've had a set of circumstances that you had no control over. Something came your way that you just couldn't expect. You had no idea it was coming. And you would hope that with the onslaught of whatever it was, you could start over, start new, start fresh. Something new could come out of something very painful and difficult. Or you may be like me, who over time have realized that some of the things that I experienced have been brought on by myself, by my decisions, things I did have control over, and I'd sure like a mulligan for. I'd like a new beginning. I'd like a fresh start. I'd like to start over again. I'd like someone to do something for me. If there's anything else that we could say about Easter Sunday morning, it is that the good news is that Jesus is our new beginning. Now, one of the things that we try to do is when we fall into one of those difficult circumstances, whether it's by our doing or a circumstance beyond our control, we decide, you know, this next time we're going to do better. So we determine that we're going to learn from our mistakes, learn from our past, or learn from that difficult experience, and we're going to manage our relationships different. We're going to learn new skills in hopes that our performance is better. And we're going to study in hopes that maybe we can gain just enough insight that the next time we'll have just the right answer and our life will be new again. But really what happens is we learn how to manage. And managing really simply means we see things as they come and we try to work through what it is in such a way through our skill set, through what we've learned, through our past experiences. We're managing. But the realities are if what we face is a consequence of our own doing, all it takes is a little bit of stress for us to show up again. Our best skills at management, they're going to fail. Whatever insight we have is going to be completely ignored. Whatever we've learned from the past, well, unfortunately, we're probably going to repeat it again. Because we can't do what the advertisers tell us. In those 30, 60, 90-second spots, we can't simply buy that thing, do that thing, participate in that thing in such a way that all of a sudden, we're different people. Truth is we are who we are. You catch, we got no amen out of that. We are who we are. And that's a reality that, thankfully, we get to see how God counters on Easter. Easter is the story that reminds us that God knows us as we are. And that is that God knows us and loves us as we are. You see, if it were really up to our energy and our effort to try to manage our relationships better, to perform better, to study harder, and in some way that would make it all better, then, like, I don't know how you describe that as anything consistent with what we know to be our experiences of love. After all, some of us are married. And we know that in the difficulties of that particular relationship, that if one or the both of us don't change along the way, no matter how well we learn to manage, no matter what we try to do about the past, no matter what skill set we think might make us better, no matter what new car or new clothes or new house or new thing we could gain for ourselves, we are who we are. We are who we are, and hopefully in that relationship of love, we are loved for who we are. And when we discover that we're loved for who we are, the consequence is God makes us who we might be. We're not talking about a love that really is just kind of sentimental. It's a really kind of a crazy thing that here in the what we consider part of the Bible Belt, the minute a church begins to talk about love or Nathan reads the love chapter, we immediately hear wedding bells, and we think that that's what that's all about. And we think that really when we get into church and we talk about love, we're just trying to draw your on your sentimental strings. We want you to feel good. We want you to kind of feel romantic and emotional. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the sort of love that takes account of who we are and loves us still. That's not a sentimental love. That's a love that once you figure out that that's all there is to it, you move on. So really, I wanted to take a look at this passage of Scripture, make a reference to one other real quickly. I was joking about 45 minutes to an hour. Really, I was. That rather than leave us to ourselves, God in Christ is our new beginning when, like Paul, we discover that our best understanding of the world turns out to be a misunderstanding. He's our new beginning when, like the disciples, we realize that as close as we were to Jesus, we had no idea what he was doing for us. He's our new beginning when, like those leaving the empty tomb, in Mark's gospel, we tremble with fear and amazed by what they had just witnessed. I want to think about Paul for a minute. One of our companion readings for today was 1 Corinthians chapter 15. It is Paul's recounting to a group of people who were mired in conflict. So that simply means they were human, right? I mean, from the very first get-go in his letter to the church at Corinth, his personal letter, where he's conveying his feelings, it is very clear from the outset that there are a group of people who are in conflict. And that conflict is generated by always wanting to be either the one in charge or influencing those who are. Now, I'd say that's pretty human. Where are you going to lunch today? Who's going to influence that decision? Who's dictating? Who's determining? If they're less than 4 feet tall, they may win. Right? Yeah. But Paul wrote this letter, and he was aiming really hard to make sure that if they continue kind of just being who they are, their whole experience is going to really mute the message that Jesus is their new beginning. And so by the time he gets to chapter 15, that chapter that we refer to as the resurrection chapter, he gives a little personal testimony. Now, you need to know that Paul was a typical human being. Though we make him out to be a saint, we make him out to be this great iconic figure, he was just a human being who had been handed a set of rules, had been given a particular view of religion, and he decided that he was right, everybody else was wrong, and what he was going to do was set out and make sure everyone knew he was right and they were wrong. And so he took this set of rules and he enforced those rules wherever he traveled. And one of those days when he was on the road making sure he could make sure everybody knew he was right and they were wrong, God interrupted him. He had one of those moments where all of a sudden, out of the blue, unsuspecting, he hears a voice, sees a light in the midst of his darkness. And he's asked this question, "Hey, why are you kicking me?" Well, it's a modern translation. Why are you kicking against the pricks in the King James? Why are you kicking it against the goads in a more modern translation? But literally, why are you kicking me? Here I am. I'm the one to whom you're laying claim to, but you're kicking me. I hope you sense at least some parallels, that it really will do us no good today to parade around our town, our community, our state, our country with the total aim to say, I'm right and you're wrong, and I'm going to make sure you know about it. Paul was actually traveling that religious road. And while he was maintaining his effort to keep the rules, he hears a voice who's saying, "Hey, you're kicking me." Now, I hope you understand, if you're close enough to be kicked, you're close, right? I mean, if someone can kick you, your proximity is such that that makes it a possibility that your shins or your legs or some part of your anatomy is going to be inflicted with a little bit of pain. So God had already been close to Paul. He had been near to Paul, but he had been very far from Paul because he had not heard the message that it wasn't about the rules he would keep, but about the relationship that he should experience. And so Paul's trying desperately to write to a group of people who are mired in conflict to say, you've just created a new set of rules. And you're just trying to keep things all together with your new rules. And I just want to tell you that it doesn't really work. That I am who I am today by the grace of God. Otherwise, I would be who I've always been. But God gave me a new beginning. He gave me a new beginning because Jesus is my new beginning. And Paul, throughout all his letters, is really saying some things that are sometimes hard for us to handle because we're a people who we want to do it ourselves. We want to make sure we achieve everything. We want to perform well. And really, Paul's summary statement is, God did it for us in Jesus. So stop. That's why we can say the good news is Jesus is our new beginning. It's what he has done for us. The invitation is not for you to do better, to try harder, to keep the rules, to keep everything all in place and well managed. The good news is that you don't have to. That's the good news. And the good news is that no matter what another human being says, it's God who tells you whether you're right or not. It's the God who makes you right. And so, like Paul, he had built his framework on a misunderstanding. And I just wonder today, it's easy to come to church and sense that I'm going to be misunderstood. It's easy for some to come on Easter and have a bit of fear that they're going to be misunderstood or maybe misunderstand. I mean, it may be this morning that some of the lyrics that we used are so foreign to you that the phrases that we used are like just a foreign language. But for us who kind of cut our teeth on the recognition that Jesus is our blessing, those words we use to describe what God has done for us in love are songs that make our hearts sing. Now, you may have heard how poor we sing, but we sing nonetheless because together we're singing the recognition that Jesus is our new beginning. And we once built our lives on a misunderstanding that it was about the rules and not a relationship. And so we kind of get a little bit happy, and we do have to remind ourselves from time to time that we shouldn't start all over again by making some new rules, but instead encourage each other in our relationships to value the one God has given us in Jesus. So Paul writes this letter of encouragement. Hey, listen, get this right. It's by God's grace you are where you are. You do what you do, and you live like you do. That's good news. Because if we are left to ourselves, we are what we are. So when we discover that we've kind of built things on a misunderstanding, we kind of often wonder, how could I misunderstand something I was so close to? Have you ever had that? I always love Eugene Peterson, who talks about the Bible this way. He said, when introducing a talk one time about the Bible, he said, I want to tell you something about the Bible. The Bible is like my relationship with my wife. And I know it's startling right up front. It's just startling right up front. But he said, I want you to know something. I know my wife after 50 years better than I've ever known my wife. And he pauses. And then he says, I don't know my wife after 50 years any better than I knew my wife the day we met. And you and I look at each other, well, how could we be so close? But you've had those experiences, haven't you? You've had deep friendships where all of a sudden you learn something you didn't know, right? I mean, you say, how can I be so close and never have known that? I thought of that when I heard Leroy tell that nurse that story. I thought, how is it I've known Leroy more than 20 years and I didn't know that? Close. How could I miss it? And don't you wonder how those who had committed themselves to traipsing around the Galilean area in Israel, not a very big place, folks, not a very big place geographically to get from one place, even if they were walking all the time, just not a big place. And what would it mean that those who were so close to Jesus didn't get what he was doing for them? I mean, how is it we can be so close and miss what's going on? But if you Look back at Mark chapter 8, verse number 31. Jesus said with great clarity to those who were there, I'm going to suffer, be handed over, I'm going to die, and I'll be raised on the third day. 8 chapters later, his followers are going to a tomb. And they're not going to the tomb because they think he's alive. They brought their spices. They hadn't quite got the knack of embalming yet. Surely he stinketh. So they were bringing the spices to put on and around the tomb so that when those who were coming to pay their respects would come, would not be repulsed by the odor. It was custom. It was practice. They brought their spices because they believed Jesus was dead. How can you be so close to hear Jesus say this is going to happen, and then you show up at his tomb and you think, I'm going to find a body? Now, I've got to tell you, you and I would expect to find a body. So let's don't pretend that somehow we're more enlightened than they were. We understand what death means. It means not coming back. So the idea that they would show up at a tomb expecting it to be empty was just like unbelievable. They went to the tomb with the spices because they thought Jesus was dead. Didn't matter how close they were to Jesus. They didn't get what he was doing for them. I mean, come on. These were the same group of people that argue about who was going to be the greatest, who was going to take his place. Told the children not to get close. I mean, after all the things that would express love and care, they were actually trying to figure out like how they fit into some new hierarchy of belonging. That's easy for us to miss. I just don't think we should decide somehow that we wouldn't miss it by being so close, because the truth of the matter is we've got some advantages that they didn't. We've got 66 books and a Bible that we believe God gave us and gives us his story. We've got some of the backstory that they didn't have while they were living it. I mean, we're reading it after the fact. We can put pieces together that they couldn't. I mean, they couldn't reference Mark 8:31 and go, how come by Mark 16, verse number 8, they're running away? But we can. And as close as we are to the sacred text, how many copies do you have in your house? We are so close, we still often miss what God is doing. We think somehow that the church's aim and intent is to make you behave better. Good luck. I've been here 24 years this July. My behavior is terrible. Yeah. Now, don't ask what I mean by that. I'm not really willing to divulge that just at the moment, right? But here we are. We're so close. We have advantages that they didn't have. And yet, how many times do we seize on an emphasis that is completely foreign to what Jesus is doing for us? And we think that all the church is, and sometimes I guess we'd have to admit it, we sometimes make it out that we just want you to come obey a new set of rules. No, we want you to find Jesus as our new beginning, our new beginning, our new beginning. Now, I knew Steve was coming. I got a long story I could tell about Steve-O and Tracy. Yeah, been out of the state for a long time when I first met old Steve. And shows up living just a half a mile down the street. Tracy shows up on a July. It's 100 plus degrees. She's in a white dress. Sits on the second row. Had no idea who she was over in the old auditorium. Gave the invitation. She comes forward and says, I want Jesus to be my new beginning. We baptized Tracy. And then she said after church, I want you to go see my husband. She told me nothing else. Nothing else. And that began a long friendship. But it could easily be said that after the experiences Steve had, some of his own doing, some of others doing, he came back looking for a new beginning. And when he discovered what that looked like, I want to tell you something. He agreed that if I would work out with him, he would read the Bible with me. And so 3 times a week, we would work out together, and then we would talk about what he was reading in the Bible. You see, it's close. It's right there. Sometimes we're so close, we don't see what Jesus is doing for us. And so we can be just like the disciples who didn't understand that they really didn't need the spices. It was, after all, the third day. But instead, they went there. It's interesting. Did you catch it? And Mark does something here that is really important. It really kind of puts it all together and scandalizes so we can get to the last point so you can get to lunch. And that is this. When the messenger inside the tomb, seated at the right, says to them, "He is not here. Jesus of Nazareth, the one who was crucified." Now listen, if you are going to set out to create a religion, and there are thousands of them, you don't begin with a central figure that's crucified. That's why we probably should say that Christianity is not a religion. It's only a religion when we make it a new set of rules for folks. Christianity is an invitation to see Jesus as humanity's new beginning, experiencing the love of God as who we are to become who He will make us. And so if we fall into the trap of creating some new rules, then please someone say, "This is the crucified one," because Jesus' death became a new designation. Crucified meant accursed. Crucified meant humiliated. Crucified meant rejected. Crucified meant powerless. Crucified meant dead. You don't build a religion on that story. But if that story communicates the depth and length and height and breadth God's love is shown to us, what Paul says in Ephesians 3, now that central image lets us know that, well, God suffered with us and for us, taking on who we were so that He could make us who we could be. And that was in the crucified one. Not the one who taught you how to manage your life a little bit better. Not the one who gave you 3 rules to a better marriage. Not the one that gave you 5 rules to better children. But the one who said, "I'm your new beginning." And so, if we want to know how they missed it, we just have to admit that we miss it. We miss it. How did the disciples miss what Jesus said? Well, we do. You know, this is a terrifying thing. And verse 8 is it, and that's where we're going to land. They left terrified. The women left terrified. I mean, right there, if you hear the story, you need to know that the first evangelists who were ordained to tell the good news of God and Jesus were women. Now, if that didn't terrify a whole group of people who thought only men could speak, that was difficult in its own right. But here, right here, the women were the ones who went to the tomb, and they were told, "Go tell your disciples He has gone into Galilee and He's going to meet you there." And they're just like, "Oh my." In fact, we try to make that nice. They were astonished. The source of what's going on there is the last phrase. They were afraid. They were afraid. I want you to know something. When you discover that someone like God, someone who is God, who's done something for you in an incredible sort of way, in a way that you couldn't imagine, dream, one that you couldn't script in the religion that you created, found out that the crucified God was now raised from the dead, I mean, if that were true, it's a little scary. No? Well, let me tell you how I know it's scary. I know it's scary because we have an awful hard time wrestling with the new people that makes us. Can you imagine? Here's the message. Go back to Galilee. This is what made me think of Stephen. Go back to Oklahoma. That's where all my trouble is. Florida's been okay. All my trouble's in Oklahoma. Why would I go back to Oklahoma? Galilee is where that all started for the disciples. It's where Jesus called them from their nets, from their tax collecting booths. It was where they started. Can you imagine the nightmare thought of going back to where it started now that you know what you know about Jesus? A little bit of embarrassment there, a little bit of humility there, but it really shouldn't be viewed that way. It should be viewed that Jesus is going there and it's going to be new. There's a new beginning for you. You disciples, you're not going to miss it because you're so close. You're not going to build your world on a misunderstanding. Instead, he's going and he's going to meet you there, and it will be a new beginning for you. If the disciples, including Peter, who was singled out here, who betrayed Jesus, could be given a new start, what do you say we can? If we could think about Peter, the one who had traveled with, was in the inner circle, the inner ring, if you will. He was in the cone of trust. He is the one who denied Jesus, and he is specifically called out to say, meet me there, because there's a new beginning. Jesus is our new beginning. That's the good news of Easter. And if you're here this morning and you think there is no hope for any new beginning for you, just read the story, please. Just read the story. Listen to the stories. There are countless stories in this room, but listen to the stories. There are new beginnings in Jesus. And so if you're here and you thought, boy, I'm going to be terrified to go into church with my family. That ceiling's going to fall in. Lightning's going to strike. All sorts of horrible things are going to happen. Remember that, Steve-O? Thought the building was going to come down. Yeah. Just read the story. New beginnings, our new beginnings are in Jesus. And if you're here and you've kind of discovered that, how have I missed Jesus so badly, so broadly? Well, there's new beginnings. The disciples did. And maybe you've discovered that you've made this relationship with God something that's really just a set of rules. And by the way, that's tough to keep. But if you're really interested in spending some time with one who loves you as you are, for who you are, and you want to spend time with a group of people who know that's who we are and what we need, well, there's new beginning for you in Jesus. The good news of Easter. God's good news for us. Jesus is our new beginning.